His talk before was on the classification and biology of Neuroptera and Leucoptera, and he's not only been persuaded to talk again, but he eagerly volunteered, and so today he's going to talk to us on the Trichoptera, the classification and biology of the Trichoptera caddisflies. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you very much. First of all, can everyone hear me all right? I'm never quite sure whether these microphones work. Yes? If you can't hear me, put your hand up, as they say. All right, good. Okay, Trichoptera or caddisflies. We all know Trichoptera are brown, boring, hairy-winged little insects. Look a bit like moths, and the larvae all build cases. Great, there's a typical life cycle up there. Now, Trichoptera, as the word Trichoptera, as all of you will no doubt remember your classical Greek, means hairy wings. But what about this word caddisfly? It's really quite an unusual word, and it's very difficult to find what the origins of the word actually are. Now, one person who had a very interesting theory about this was Norman Hickin, who some of you may have heard of. He worked a lot on caddisflies in the 1950s and 60s, also worked on wood-boring beetles and various things. And he discovered there was a very early English word called a caddisman. And a caddisman, it turns out, was somebody who used to travel around the countryside selling cloth and ribbons and bits of lace and things like that. And he took samples around with him, as these salesmen do. Since he didn't have a sort of suitcase of samples in the back of his cortina in those days, he had to have all these samples of material pinned all over his coat. And Hickin's theory was that this name of caddisman was transferred to caddis larvae because the larval cases look as if they've got bits and pieces pinned all over them. Well, it's a nice idea. It's an attractive sounding theory. But there is actually another theory, which I suspect may be more nearer the truth. If you look at the very early printed books on angling and anything about natural history, you'll actually find that caddis larvae were called cadworms or codworms. Now, cod in that sense has got nothing to do with the fish cod. It's actually an old English word meaning a purse or a bag or something. Hence codpiece, of course, in Shakespearean times. And I think it's really just because the larvae build this little pod-shaped case. If you look in most other European languages, the common name of the caddisfly is usually based on the form of the case. It's often the same word meaning a quiver for arrows. So I think actually that's probably where it comes from, although Hickin's theory is rather nice. Now, having said they build cases, in fact, when we start looking into it, only about half the species in the world build cases. Quite a lot of them are free living. And I'll look into the evolutionary reasons for that a little bit later on. Now, I've mentioned that the larvae have been written about for a very long time. They've certainly been known and recognised as an important freshwater insect for a long time. And adult caddisflies have been known about for a long time. In fact, if we look at some early pictures, this is a kind of montage of early pictures from 16th and early 17th century works. There are some there that, well, some of these are probably beetle larvae, in fact. Not sure about these three, but this one, and this one, and this one, and this one are certainly caddis larvae. There's no doubt about that. And this, and this, and this, almost certainly that one, are adult caddisflies. Now, these occur in similar books. In fact, some of those occur in the same book. But no author at that time, whether they were a fisherman or a natural historian or anybody else, made the link between the larvae and the adults. And it wasn't till nearly 200 years later that people realised that caddis worms grew up into the adult flies. We can tell that because they have completely different names up until that period. Caddis fly wasn't used for adults until the early 19th century. And these early works called them water moths and water flies and all kinds of words like that. In fact, Isaac Walton, in his famous Complete Angler, says that caddis larvae grow up into mayflies, which does rather confuse the taxonomy a little bit. But here we are. So it took an awful long while to make this connection between the larval stages and the adult stages. And that, for that reason, of course, the classification was very much based on adults, as it tends to be in most groups, I guess. And if you look at any 19th century books on caddis flies, this was the main classification. Now, the families don't really matter very much, so you don't really need to look at those. It's really just these two so-called suborders, which the cladists among you will be a bit unhappy about, I suspect. The characters that it's being based on. Females have 5 maxillary joints in both groups. Males have 5 in one, but fewer than 5 in the other group, which is not really a very helpful kind of classification. But this persisted for the best part of a century, and it was all we had for a very long time. In fact, the number of maxillary palp joints in the male can be 2, 3, or 4 in this second suborder. In fact, even worse than that, the book on British caddis flies, which was published in 1939 by Moseley, had as the very first key couplet to the key to families, males and females with the same number of maxillary palp segments, or males and females with different number of maxillary palp segments. Now, if you think about it, that's a pretty hard key couplet to use, because it assumes you have a male and female, and you know that they're the same species to start with. So. And that's what we had to struggle with for a very long time. And nothing better turned up, really, until, well, in fact, the major breakthrough was 1967. I'm sure many of you will have heard of Herbert Ross, who was principally a tricopterologist, as the Americans like to call them. But he wrote a very famous textbook on entomology in general. He was a very good all-round entomologist. And he had a look at the higher classification of caddis flies, and he came up with this. Now again, I wouldn't worry about the family names at the top. But the important thing is, he managed to combine that earlier classification, which was based on maxillary palp segments, which are mentioned various places in here and here and so on, with features of the wing venation. We've got various notes about M4 here on the veins, whether ocelli are present or not. There's also a lot of larval characters there, you can see. Larval leg articulations, the claspers, the gills, all kinds of things, plus the type of case that they built, which is just up here, and also whether they're case makers or net builders, which we'll come on to in a minute. So there's a little bit of sort of behavioural character in there as well. And it also appeared, once we started looking at this classification, that it fitted ecological groups as well. So it really is a very robust kind of classification, using adult characters, larval characters, behavioural ones, and ecological ones. Well, you would think that would be pretty much it, apart from just fiddling with details from then on, but unfortunately, in the 80s, the molecular taxonomists came along. I say unfortunately. This was a group of American PhD students who were very keen to apply their new techniques to this group, mainly because their supervisors were interested in caddis flies. And within the space of 5 years, I think we had about 8 different, totally different classifications produced based on far too few characters. And of course, everyone has just ignored all of those now. We've really stuck with this. I think it's that kind of thing that gives molecular taxonomy a bad name, of course. It's not really the fault of the process at all. It's the people not understanding what they're doing and not taking other characters into account at the same time. So we just don't mention molecular taxonomy in Trichoptera systematics anymore. We just quote Herb Ross and say, yes, he got it right 40 years ago. And it still is basically the classification we use today. We've added a few new families and so on, but it really does work extremely well. Just to give you a few figures, the size of the group, there's about 10,000 species described in the Trichoptera. So it's a fairly small group, really, in insect terms. And there are now about 40 families, some of which are very small, some of which are monotypic, in fact, and some extremely large, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, Trichoptera are the sister group of the Lepidoptera. This is very well established sister group, pair, based on morphology, on modern morphology, based on the fossil record as well, because there is an ancestral group, a stem group, to the Trichoptera and Lepidoptera, which Niels Christensen called the Amphiesmenoptera, which simply means clothed wings or covered wings, which diverged into the Trichoptera with hairy wings and the Lepidoptera with scaly wings. And there really is quite a clear fossil record of these early stem group ones and then a split into the two orders. It's quite a neat story. Basically, we've got Amphiesmenoptera, the stem group from Permian up to the Triassic, which is the sort of beginning of the Mesozoic. And then we've got clear Trichoptera and Lepidoptera fossils from the Jurassic onwards. So they're something like 200 million years old as discrete orders. Okay, let's have a look at some adult morphology. I'm not going to bore you with too much morphology because I think morphology's not terribly interesting unless you're really into the group. A little bit about the mouth parts, first of all. I'll explain the cutout in the corner in a minute, in case you're wondering about that. This is some work done by my old PhD supervisor Ian Crichton at Reading, back in the 50s, in fact, he did this. He got very interested in adult caddisfly mouth parts, because all the books up to that stage had just said mouth parts reduced, presumably non-functional. Now, he had a rather close look at it and realised, yes, they are somewhat reduced, but they're certainly not non-functional. The mandibles tend to be reduced to these little tiny soft parts, which have got no obvious function at all. But the palps are very large, and you have this very, very large structure on the labium, which is now called a horstellum, and it looks very much like the horstellum you get in the Hyodiptera, and it certainly is used for lapping up fluids. Adult caddisflies do take in water, they take in any kind of sugary fluid they can get hold of, like nectar and honeydew and that kind of thing, and they'll feed very readily in captivity. So I'm quite sure they do have to actively feed in order to reproduce correctly. The little tubes, little very fine tubes on this horstellum lead up into a groove which leads into the mouth. It's very similar to the structure in Hyodiptera. Now, Crichton got very interested in the structure of that horstellum because it had not been studied before. Now, as I said, this was back in the 50s. In those days, we didn't have SEMs and such things. So he cut serial sections of these mouth parts and reconstructed it from consecutive serial sections, which was actually quite a difficult job in those days. And he produced this drawing, which was the first one anyone had ever produced of the kind of fine structure. Can everyone see that? The sort of fine structure of the processes on this horstellum. You can see kind of fine filaments at the top and deeper channels underneath, which channel the liquid up towards the mouth. Well, when I got along to Reading, by that time we had an SEM there, and I said to Ian Crichton, well, why not have a look at the same structure under the SEM, which he was a bit reluctant to do in case it turned out all his theories were completely wrong several years back. But eventually he did, and I've got a picture. I'm not sure how this well this is going to come out on here. Probably that way around would be best. No, that way around. Is that going to be visible? Just about visible. You can see these larger pieces coming up from here, the fine filaments on top and the channels up between them. And in fact, everything was exactly right. I mean, his reconstruction from serial sections was absolutely spot on. And you can see the scale here. I mean, that's 20 microns across there. So it was to do that from reconstructed sectioning was actually pretty good going. So he was quite relieved about that. Actually published a second paper on it. just to prove he was right. So there's not much else to say about adult mouth parts. The palps are really sensory organs for detecting water and so on, which they need to feed on. Not much else to say about the head or the antennae, really. Just usual sort of structures. They have ocelli in some groups. There's either three ocelli or none, but the actual number, the actual presence or absence of ocelli doesn't seem to fit the rest of the phylogeny particularly well. So it's one of those classic cases where we don't really know what the function of the ocelli it can be. Thorax gets a little bit more interesting, a little bit more embarrassing as well, because we know so little about it. These are just taken from British Trichoptera, in fact, so it's by no means the full range of structures you find on the thorax. You can see there's actually quite a lot of variation. There's lots of different shapes of the main sclerites. There's lots of secondary parts. There are lots of processes with various spines and things on them. And there's no doubt this would be a very useful character to look at from a phylogeny point of view. But of course, nearly all our specimens have got dirty great pins right through the thorax, and we can't see most of these structures. So there are really quite a lot of groups, particularly some of the earlier monotypic groups, where we only have one specimen from a family, and we can't tell what the thorax is like, because it's got a number 5 pin right through it. Nowadays, the tendency is to preserve Trichoptera in alcohol, so we can see the thoracic structures a bit better. So we ought to be using the thorax, but we're not. And in fact, the main sort of broad classification of adult Trichoptera is based on wing venation and on the spurs on the legs. This has been used right from the beginning of the study of adults. Spurs on the legs are fairly straightforward in most groups. It's quoted as a spur formula, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with in other groups, simply quoting the number of spurs on a front leg, a middle leg, and a hind leg. So in this case, it would be 3, 4, 4, which is the sort of basic number for Trichoptera, and you get reduction in various groups, down to as little as 0, in fact. Slight complication is that the most common families, particularly in Europe anyway, do have a lot of spines on the legs as well as spurs, and it does take a little bit of practice to try and sort out which ones are the spurs and which ones are the spines. They're often a little bit darker, it doesn't show up. I have deliberately didn't blacken them in this picture to make it difficult for you, but the spurs are always paired. If there are two of them, they always come from apparently the same socket and the same layer. And they're either at the end of the tibia or about a third of the way up the tibia. So you get to know where to look for them. But it does cause a lot of confusion with beginners to this group. Puts them right off from the very beginning, in fact, from trying to identify even to family level. And I can understand how they feel. And as I said, the other main feature we use for classifying and identifying the major groups is the wing venation. Now that's a very basic Trichoptera wing venation. I'm sure you all remember the details of Lepidoptera wing venation from earlier groups, from earlier talks, so I don't need to go over it again. But the important thing is that the Trichoptera have M4 separate from M3 in the forewing, which in general doesn't occur in Lepidoptera. They normally have M3 plus 4 fused. The other oddity, these anal veins, which A2 and A3 loop into A1, and that's a very characteristic of Trichoptera. Having said that, of course, there's lots of reduction variation in various groups, so this is really only a kind of basal structure. But you do see it in quite a lot of families. Now, I've said that Trichoptera do have hairy wings, but some of them do have scales on the wings as well, very much like Lepidopteran scales. But of course, a lot of other insects have scales as well. They're only flattened macrocoeti, really, nothing very special about it. But I'll show you some slides in a minute just to show you how closely similar they are to Lepidopteran scales. Okay, I'll move on to larval morphology. Now that's just a kind of mixture of various larvae and cases and things, all sorts of different types. I'm sure many of you have seen cases before. They're made of all kinds of materials. Sometimes they're small sand grains or pebbles like this. Sometimes they're plant material. Sometimes they're small pieces of plant material. Sometimes they're almost whole sections of leaves. Some have a very characteristic spiral structure to them. Some have this rather nice, what the Americans call a log cabin builders, which I think is exactly the right name for these things, although they do occur all over the Northern Hemisphere. And you can see that larvae have got very different characteristics as well. I'll look in a little bit more detail at that. The one right at the top there, that C, is, and the case underneath it, is D is the one it lives in, is one of the so-called micro caddisflies, the Hydroptilidae, which are a very, very strange group. They're extremely small. Caddisflies in general are a sort of medium-sized insects. The adults of those have a wing length of 2 to 4 millimetres at the most, so they really are microlepidoptera size. The larvae are correspondingly small, but they often have these grotesquely fat abdomens and extended segments, and really very weird-looking things altogether. And they build very strange cases. I mean, this one is what we call a purse case because it's two kind of flattened sections put together, and sometimes made of sand grains like that, sometimes made of algae, of spiral algae, wound round and round in a spiral. But they only build that case in the last larval instar, which is very unusual for caddis. They normally either build cases throughout their life or they don't build them at all. So it's really quite an unusual family. And one I should point out is this one here, the aptly named Helicopsychidae family, which occurs in Europe, although not in Britain. Cases are clearly very much like mollusk shells, and in fact the first ones were described as late as 1870. It was first described as a mollusk, in fact, which doesn't really say too much for the powers of observations at that time, but it's actually called Valvata something or other and described as a mollusk species. But the larva just lives in the kind of bottom whorl of the case and extends the size of the case very much the way a mollusk does. So yes, let's get on to building cases. I mean, how and why do they build them? Well, they basically build them out of silk and stick materials onto the outside. Some of them, in fact, none of the ones really in that picture are solely of silk. This one probably is, actually. This may be a purely silk one. It's a kind of brownish, tough, leathery kind of silk that it ends up as. But they usually stick something else on the outside. But what's puzzled people for very many years is how the cases grow as the larvae grow, because obviously they molt 5 times as larvae, and they grow quite rapidly in size at each molt. Now, what do? Do they build a new case? Do they evacuate the old one, which would be rather dangerous because it leaves quite vulnerable while they build a new one? Or do they somehow extend the old one by, you know, taking it out a bit, like putting pleats in it or something? Nobody knew this until really not quite recently, in fact, probably about 1900 thereabouts, when someone actually had a look to see what they were doing when they molted. This is actually what happens. It's one of those things that's obvious when you think about it. As the larva gets bigger, it builds bigger particles on the front of the case. When it gets to a certain size, when it can live entirely in the front half, it bites off the back half and throws it away. And it keeps on doing that throughout its life. So effectively the case gets bigger and bigger towards the front, and the small back half gets chopped off every time. So it never has to leave its case for any reason at all, so it stays safe. And this is true of any cow. I mean, that's the type that has big stones along the side, but it's true of any type of case, whether it's a spiral one or a straight one or any shape at all. Now, what about the function of cases? I guess if you ask most people what they're for, they would say, well, it's obviously camouflage. And that, you'd think it would be camouflage because they They use different materials on the outside. The materials often reflect the substrate that they're living on. So if they're in stony streams, they'll use stones and so on. But in fact, probably they're not very good as camouflage. In fact, they're not needed as camouflage because an awful lot of caddis larvae are nocturnal. They don't move around in the daytime. You find them under stones in the daytime, but you don't see them walking around much in daylight. But the ones that do walk around very frequently get eaten by large fish like trout, whether they've got camouflage cases or not. In fact, whether they've got huge cases with great long twigs along the side, the trout still eat them. So they don't seem to be very effective as camouflage. Those ones with long twigs, there has been a theory that it helps them to walk along in fast water because it gives a kind of stability to the case. But, well, again, some use twigs and some don't. So we're not too sure about that. The main function of the case is actually to help respiration of the larva. And in a few minutes, I'll show you a slide explaining exactly how that works. Again, that was only realised relatively recently. Now, if the oxygen in the water they're in becomes too low and they can't respire inside the case, then the larva will actually leave its case as a last resort. It will come out into the open and just stays quiescent until oxygen levels build up. And I perhaps ought to say something about if you're trying to collect caddis larvae here, because a lot of people collect freshwater insects and stick them in water. Well, of course, the water rapidly becomes deoxygenated and the larvae will all die. That's true of almost any freshwater insect. So the trick is to try and transport them in damp water weed, not in water itself. But the other problem with caddisfly larvae is that if you put them in damp water weed, they will probably come out of their cases anyway. And so if you mix them all up, when you get back to the lab, you'll have a bag or whatever full of larvae and full of cases, and you'll never know which one went with which. So keep them separate if you're going to try and transport them anywhere. Right, let's have a look at the let's have a look. I'll show you a slide in a minute. I'll just mention that the larvae, because I've mentioned that they build that they spin silk to build their cases from, they've got silk glands on the mouth parts, which I'll show you a slide of in a minute. They have various other special structures to help them build in cases. They have a big sort of horn that comes out of the prothorax, out of their chest, so to speak. And again, it was a very long time before people knew what this horn was for. It sticks out between the front legs. It's nearly as long as the front legs in some species. It looks a very awkward kind of thing, which would stop it moving around very easily. In fact, it's something that an engineer would recognise immediately. It's really a kind of length gauge, if you like. Because when a caddis is building its case, it picks up a particle of vegetation or stone or whatever it's going to use, and it knows it's the right size to put on its case by holding it up against this process out of its chest. And if it's about the same length, then it says, right, that'll do, and it sticks it on the front. If it's too small, it rejects it. If it's too large, it rejects it. And of course, this horn grows as the larva grows, so it automatically builds bigger cases because its measuring stick is getting bigger as well. It's one of those strange things. Again, seems a very natural way of doing things, but you would wonder how these things have evolved. There we are. Larvae, the case-building larvae, also have processes on the abdomen which hold them in the case. And again, you'll see that in the slides in a minute. And nearly all of them have gills. Now, whether they're in well-oxygenated water or not, whether they're in cases or not, they nearly all breathe through gills on the abdomen. And we'll see some pictures in a minute of those. Okay, so we have larvae, some free-living and some in cases, and then they pupate. Now, even the free-living ones always build a case to pupate in. The ones that have a case already will simply modify it to build for a pupal case. The others will build a brand new case just to pupate in. Now, pupa, although it's a free living pupa, it's not a sort of obtect one like Lepidoptera pupae, it can't move around all that much. And it has to stay in this case and try and breathe and all the rest while it's changing into the early adult form. So it has to be very careful about respiration. It puts a grill over the front and back of the case, which obviously lets water come through so it can still respire, but it keeps out predators and parasites and things which otherwise might attack it in the open entrance to this case. But clearly this grill could get clogged up with silt and so on. So when I show you a picture of a pupa in a minute, you'll see that it has devices for clearing these grills, like some drain clearing rods, to make sure it can breathe throughout the pupal life. The one special feature about caddisfly pupae is that they have these very unusual, very large mandibles which cross over so that the teeth point outwards, which looks a very inefficient way of having mandibles. It looks like they're sort of back to front. But you can see that when they want to come out of the case, when they're ready to swim up to the surface and for the adult to emerge, they simply stick those through the grill at the end of the case, or through the silken side or whatever, open the mandibles, and that cuts a hole through. And it would actually be much more efficient to do it that way than to try and cut inwards onto a piece of silk. So it's a very straightforward way of breaking your way out through a case like that. Okay, so that's brought us back to the sort of adult stage, because we've got the pupa has swum up to the surface and the adult's emerged. What do adults actually do? Well, obviously they mate, which is their main function. A lot of them mate in the daytime or at dusk. There aren't so many that mate in absolute darkness, although most adult activity is in the night hours. A lot of the species do form quite large swarms in the daytime. Some of you may have seen these swarms around large lakes and so on. In fact, if you go up to the Serpentine in mid-July, almost every afternoon you'll see quite large swarms of a very common caddisfly up there. And these are mainly male swarms which form for some while, and then the females become attracted in visually, because the males, in fact, have got very long and very pale antennae which act as visual markers. And the females are attracted in. They also have very large eyes to see these antennae, so they're very much adapted to this swarming behaviour. Now, some species, little Lepidopterists amongst you all know, do fly at night. They come to light traps, and a lot of people do catch caddisflies at light traps, but there are only certain species that are attracted to light, not necessarily UV light, but to any light. And so light traps don't actually give a very good picture of what species are around in any particular place. You have to use a whole variety of techniques for catching caddisflies. You've got to do individual sweeping and actually looking under leaves, all kinds of things. You've really got to use a whole battery of techniques to get a good sample. And those very tiny ones I mentioned, those micro hydroptilidae, they do come to light, but they actually are quite reluctant to fly. And if you look around on stone bridges and so on sunny days next to typical fresh, suitable fresh water, you'll often see them running around in their hundreds, little tiny black insects. They look very much like ants running around, and often quite large numbers all bumping into each other, a bit the way ants look as if they're doing. But they are micro caddisflies, and they're extremely common, but very hard to find. So, adults are there to mate, basically, and this is where life gets a little bit complicated for caddisflies, because some caddis live in temporary fresh water, which means it dries up in the summer. Now, for any freshwater insect, if its freshwater is going to dry up at some stage, then one of the stages in the life cycle has got to last through that period somehow. Now, in some groups, the larvae do that. They sometimes burrow down into the mud and that kind of thing. Caddis have chosen, if that's the right word, for the adults to survive through the summer, through this dry period. Now, adults, as we've seen, are not particularly good at feeding. They can take in some liquid food, so they wouldn't seem to be an ideal choice for the summer period of survival. And the other question is, when are they going to mate? When are they going to lay their eggs and so on? Well, what happens is, and this was noted a very long time ago, that they emerge in the spring and they mate almost immediately. But then they go up into the tops of the trees and sit there and do virtually nothing. And the important thing here is that not only are the females up in the tops of the trees, but the males are there as well. Although mating has already occurred, the males survive all through the winter. Or through the summer, sorry, through the summer. And in the autumn, they all start getting reactivated again, they all start flying around, and they mate again. And then the females lay their eggs. Now the big question was, of course, why on earth do they mate twice? Is there sperm passed on both occasions or not? And this wasn't known. In fact, this is the very topic I did my PhD on, was trying to find out what these double matings were all about. And if you're wanting to know the answer, I still don't know the complete answer, but I can tell you some of the story. It turned out to be very difficult to unravel what was going on. When they mate in the spring, sperm is passed quite normally, and when they mate in the autumn, sperm is again passed quite normally. And a spermatophore, which you may remember hearing about in Lepidoptera and some other groups, which is a big kind of protein mass containing the sperm, is also passed on both occasions. Now, why on earth do you need to pass sperm twice and pass a spermatophore twice? Well, one theory I had, and I couldn't really prove it one way or the other, was that the protein that's passed in the spermatophore is actually an important food source for the female. The female has got to last all through the summer and build up her egg supply. She can't take in very much food, so the male virtually sacrifices all of his protein into this protein mess, which he passes on to the female. But trying to actually prove that that's the case is actually very difficult, but it seems a reasonable idea. No one's got any further with that idea in the last sort of several years. I'll just show you a very quick, very rough picture of what the female reproductive system's like. It's very much like the Lepidoptera system. You have the ovaries up here. This is the sort of external entrance. The sperm, there's a kind of tubular process from the male ediagus, comes right in up here and into here, into the entrance of the bursa. And protein comes into this large mass of the bursa. The sperm end up here in this sperm sac at the kind of neck of the bursa. And then the sperm eventually migrate up into this sac up here and then fertilize the eggs as they come down the oviducts. There's a bursal gland here which actually has enzymes in it that help to break down the protein so the protein can be absorbed by the female. And these large glands here provide the kind of jelly substrate that the eggs are laid in. So it's a fairly straightforward and, as I say, very similar to the Lepidoptera system. I'll show you a bit more detail on the slides in a minute for that. So if we move on to oviposition itself, well, caddisflies are obviously freshwater insects, so obviously they lay their eggs in water. Well, not necessarily. They don't always lay their eggs in water at all. Most of them do, yes. Most of them, in fact, the females walk down under the surface of the water. They walk down stones or stems of plants, deposit their eggs directly on the bottom or on a stone or on the plant stem itself. And they seem to have kind of favourite places they go to, because again, something I noticed when I was at Reading several years ago, I saw, in fact, what's the earliest caddisfly in the year, a thing called Brachycentrus, that the fishermen call the Granum or Greentail. It's called the Greentail because the females fly around with a big mass of eggs on the back end of the abdomen. It's a big bright green spot that you can see. And I noticed these females walking down a fence post that was standing in the river. They walk down probably 10 centimetres below the surface, laid their eggs, and walked back up again, flew away. And there were hundreds of females of this species all standing on this fence post, all waiting their turn to get down. They were literally shoulder to shoulder, waiting their turn to get down this post to lay their eggs where the other ones had laid their eggs. And this post ended up, it was a kind of 10 centimetre square post, it ended up twice that size in thickness with egg masses. It was just thick with jelly egg masses. There were probably tens of thousands on this single post. And I came back to have a look at the thing about 2 weeks later, and the post had got washed away downstream. Now, I rather suspect, of course, that's virtually wiped out the population of that species in that part of the river. And in fact, that species is not now present in that river. I could well have witnessed the entire collapse of that population at that time. It shows that the dangers of actually following someone else and not using your own initiative about where to lay your eggs. Like that. Something like not putting all your eggs on one fence post or something. That's a well-known expression. So they're clearly very vulnerable to things like that. They're vulnerable to being washed away anyway, like so many freshwater insects in fast water. The question people often ask you is, if an adult lays its eggs in fresh water here, and it's very fast water, the eggs will get washed downstream, the larvae surely get washed downstream, surely they all end up in the sea eventually. Well, in fact, a lot of adult freshwater insects have got a technique for getting around that, because when they emerge, they fly upstream a long way, lay their eggs higher upstream, so by the time all this drifting occurs, they're pretty well back where they ought to be to start with. It's just one of those neat little mechanisms that you see. As I've said, some adults walk underwater, some actually swim underwater to lay their eggs. They swim down, and you can tell those females because the middle legs are very, very broad and fringed. They're very clearly adapted for swimming. Right, so do they all lay their eggs underwater? No, they don't, because you remember I mentioned about these ones that live in temporary freshwater. Well, there's not much point laying your eggs if there's no water there. And the female can't wait. Once the eggs are mature, once they've been fertilised, she has got to lay her egg. She can't hang around and wait for water to turn up. So they have another neat mechanism for getting around that. One of the very common species that does this lives in temporary pools in woodland. It's very common in Britain. And it somehow knows where the pools are going to form each year. I mean, if you walk through woodland in the summer, you'll see little hollows probably filled with dead leaves, which may or may not become pools in the winter. But it's not that easy to tell, because the leaves get blown around and covered and all the rest. But somehow, these insects know which ones are going to become pools in the winter. It may be that they can pick up some kind of chemical signal from the, I don't know, dead algae or something that are in that hollow. Somehow they know. And they lay their eggs not in that hollow, because after all, if it didn't fill up for a little while, they would just be dry, or they might get damp from the dampness of the leaf litter, but there wouldn't be enough water for the larvae to hatch in. So that wouldn't be a very clever thing to do. In fact, they fly straight up from these little pools, up to about head height for us, I guess, 1.5 metres, something like that, lay their eggs on a leaf, on a living tree, that's overhanging that pool, on the underside of the leaf, and that's all they do, they fly away. And it sounds a bit hit and miss. In fact, it's quite a neat little solution, because when the rain starts in the autumn, or whenever, or summer in this case, in this year, it starts to run down the leaves and starts to moisten those egg masses. Now, they don't get washed off straight away, because again, that would be too dangerous a strategy, because the pool might not be ready yet. So the first few drops soften the egg mass and the eggs start to hatch, start to expand, the jelly starts to expand, the larvae will hatch out into the first instar, even start swimming around in the jelly. But that will take 2 or 3 weeks, and it will only continue if water is continually coming down onto that leaf. So the larvae are not ready to drop off the leaf into the pool until it's been raining for quite some time, and they can be pretty sure there is going to be a pool underneath for them to drop into. So it's a nice kind of self-regulating mechanism. If the water supply dries up for a week or two, they simply don't develop anymore. They just stay at whatever stage they are and wait for more water to come. So it's a very, very simple but very neat mechanism that they use. And we get, as I'm sure Lee would confirm, we get inquiries about this every year. I've seen some very strange eggs in massive jelly hanging on a leaf in the middle of a forest. There's no water anywhere nearby. What on earth are they? And when I get told they're caddisfly eggs, I don't think they believe it really, but it is a very, very common thing to see. Okay, I've been talking about all these slides. Let me show you some of these slides now. I think we'll need the lights right down for this because they're a little bit dark, some of these. This is just to prove that there are some fossil Trichoptera around. These are actually fairly late tertiary ones, but there's an adult and a larva there. The larval case is quite clearly a caddisfly case, there's not much doubt about that. And of course there are plenty of caddisflies in Baltic amber and so on, so we do actually know a fair amount about the fossil history of the group. Sorry, these are a little bit dark, some of these slides. This is that very common woodland species I was telling you about, that lays its eggs on the leaves overhanging pools. It's a very characteristic wing pattern, and it's got a big notch out of the end of the forewing, which you might just be able to see in that slide. Gives it a very characteristic wing shape. It's quite a large species too. Now this is one of those swarming ones, like the sort you'll see up on any large lake in the summer. This is the family Leptoceridae. As you can see, very long antennae, very pale antennae, and you can see why they'd be very good visual signals, especially in a large swarm. You can just see this mass of white antennae fluttering. You can't see the wings very well, but you can always see the antennae catching the light. I'm tempted to say yet another caddisfly. They do tend to look rather the same after a while. Just remind you of the sort of characteristic way caddisfly adults sit. The wings are always folded in this kind of roof shape over the body, which really just keeps the rain off the body as much as anything. And that's very important with these ones, that the females that carry eggs around on the end of the abdomen. Because if it kept raining on those, then they would hatch while still on the end of the abdomen, which wouldn't be very convenient. So they are actually tucked away under the wings. So I guess there is a good reason for that shape. That's the female of that common woodland species I was saying. Again, you can see that notch out of the back end of the forewing there. So female's got quite different colours, but she's got exactly the same wing shape. And this is one of our larger species. I mean, you can't really tell, I guess, from the picture, but its wing length is about 30 millimetres, I suppose. So it's actually quite a large insect in caddis terms. And quite a striking wing pattern too, very pronounced black and white. Now this is one of the British equivalents of the log cabin case builders, I guess. It's a very fairly typical family. The Limnophilidae is actually the biggest family in Britain, biggest in the Northern Hemisphere, in fact, by far the dominant family. And most of them tend to build cases like this with lots of strange materials added. This one's mainly plant stems, as you can see. But some use quite a variety. Some use small stones and plant fragments and even small snail shells. And there are some wonderful stories of people who have seen them using snail shells which weren't even empty at the time. So this poor snail suddenly finds itself upturned and stuck onto the back of a caddisfly, and it's stuck there forever and eventually dies. Caddis and larvae are not very discriminating about things like that. If it's the right size, it's good enough for me, is a motto, I think. And this is that woodland species I was talking about earlier, the one that lays its eggs on the leaves. The larvae sort of half come out of the case in this picture, but you can see, I hope, that the case is made of just big, large circles of leaves, not small fragments, but very large ones. When that of course is upside down at the moment because the larva is sticking out this way. If you imagine it the other way up in a pool full of leaf litter, there's no way you would ever see that. These are the two main types of caddis. The two at the bottom are really much the same as each other. Free living caddis larvae, the ones at the top. Prognathous head pointing forwards, large hooks on the back end, and you can see these very long bristles on the back end as well. That's because this is one. This is a net spinning species. It catches its prey by spinning silk nets to act as a kind of filter feeder, and it uses those bristles to prod through the holes every now and again to clear the silt out, so the net doesn't get useless. The two at the bottom are typical case-building types, which have head pointing downwards, erusiform larvae. And you can see on the on this first abdominal segment, get this right way around, this process, it's in all of them, two lateral processes and one dorsal process. And that those processes hold the caddis centrally in the case, and you'll see why in a minute. I should perhaps add, if you want to get a caddisfly larva out of its case, what you never ever do is pull it out the front, because at the back end it has these little hooks which are held into the back of the case, and the harder you pull, the harder it will hold on. Eventually it will break in half if you do that. In fact, it physically can't let go because these things are hooked in and it can't unhook them. The way to get a caddis out of its case is to stick something blunt up the back end. It doesn't like that, and it will come out very quickly. So, little tip for you there if you want to know. This is just a comparison of the larval mouth parts with Lepidoptera at the top and Trichoptera larvae at the bottom. In broad terms, you can see they are extremely similar. You have a spinning gland opening on the labium, very, very similarly in both cases. The whole structure of the palps and everything is incredibly similar. Not much more to say than that, I think. Mandibles of the larvae are rather more variable because of the different feeding habits, which I'll mention in a moment. There's just a few more case types, a bit like the ones we saw earlier. Very occasionally you get a larva that builds a case from a whole stem, a whole hollow stem from a reed or something, but that really is quite unusual. They normally build up the case from fragments to suit what they want. There's those helical ones again. There's a nice little square one. That's quite a common one in this country. Very characteristic square case. But you can just see the range of things there, overlapping sort of scale-like fragments, spiral ones, these sand grain ones, all kinds. And usually closely related, at least to generic level classification, not to species, but you can normally tell what genus something is. Now this is why they have those processes on the abdomen, holding it centrally, because they undulate the body up and down and create a water current going right through the case, in at the front end, all round the abdomen because it's held in the middle, and out through a hole in the back. And this way, of course, it gets far more oxygen from the water than it would just sitting in open water, because even in still water, it's generating its own current. Although it uses a moderate amount of energy doing that, it's still an efficient way of respiring. So this really is the main function of the case, because it happens in all the case-building species. Now, just a bit of fun. There's a few slides I prepared for a talk many years ago comparing Trichoptera and Lepidoptera. These are very typical caddisfly cases, of course, except that they're not. These are all caddisfly cases along the bottom. These are Lepidopteran cases of the family Psychidae, the bagworms. You can see the construction is extremely similar. I would be very hard put to tell them apart if the larva wasn't there. Clearly they're using the same kind of techniques on a silk base and so on, but they're clearly using the same kind of process to build it as well. That's the pupa. We saw the pupal mandibles earlier. And again, they have these long bristles at the back end. They use those to clear out the grills in the pupal case so that the respiratory flow keeps on going for the couple of weeks or so that the pupa is developing inside the closed case. Just to show they're not all brown, boring things, I'm sorry it's a pin specimen, but some of the groups of caddisflies do have really quite striking wing patterns in yellows and browns and various things. So another quite nice one. In fact, when that's alive, it has a kind of purple sheen to it, which doesn't really photograph very well. And some are really quite unusual wing shapes as well, very Lepidopteran looking in their appearance, in fact, although I wouldn't like to put a family on it. Another fun slide I prepared some while ago, again but talking about Lepidoptera as well. The two at the top are caddisflies, in case you're not sure. The two at the bottom are Lepidoptera. It's a zygaenid on that side and a dioptid on this side, for those of you who know these groups. And even in the more primitive groups, we get very close superficial similarities. Gaydon will no doubt recognise these two, Kevin as well, I should think. Very primitive moth family, the Agathophagids. These two are typical primitive caddisflies. But it's interesting that the primitive caddis look like primitive moths and the advanced caddis look a bit like advanced moths. So I won't draw any more conclusions than that. Now, I mentioned this reproductive system. This is a dissected out bursa copulatrix from a female caddisfly. That's the main mass of the bursa. You possibly just about see the sperm sac in there. You can just see the dark outline of it. And this is all the big protein mass formed from the spermatophore, which gets absorbed by the female and I'm sure helps her nutrition. That's a section through the sperm sac. You can see it's got quite a thick cuticular wall, and this is just solid with sperm swimming around inside. That's a section through the wall of the bursa, and this is the rather amorphous protein mass inside, which gets gradually absorbed through the wall of the bursa. I couldn't resist showing you these slides. I took these when I was doing my PhD. I don't think I've used them since, so I had to use them somehow. This is a little project I did with John Huxley a few years back on the wing scales in Trichoptera. This species has got quite pronounced pattern on the wing. That's just in ordinary light. Under UV, you can see these stripes and spots shine out quite strongly. And I'm quite sure this is, and the stripes along here as well, and on the body even. So I'm quite sure this has got a definite visual function, probably visual signalling for mating. But it's quite a rare South American species. We don't know much more about it than that. This is another one. This is an African species. And you can see here that certain scales on this wing are glowing under UV quite strongly against the background. That doesn't show up under visual light. So again, I'm quite sure there's an important signalling system there. These are actually the scales on that last wing we looked at. They look very much like Lepidopteran scales superficially. They do when you get down to a higher power as well. You can start to see very tiny cross divisions between all these long ridges. And in section, the structure is moderately similar as well. I won't go into much detail, but those of you who've looked at Lepidopteran scales will know it is actually a very, very similar process, very similar structure. Right, I think that's all the slides. Now, I've mentioned just very briefly that caddis live in all kinds of habitats. They're in still water, running water, cold springs, warm springs, stagnant ditches. Some of them live on just a trickle of water running over rocks or running between mosses and that kind of thing. They're found in almost every type of freshwater. Because they're very specific to their own kind of freshwater, they're very good indicators of habitats. And there is, in fact, in this country, there is one terrestrial caddis larva, which not many people seem to know about, although it's fairly common in the oak woodlands in the West Midlands and North Midlands. Norman Hickin actually discovered the larva of this back in the 1950s. And just before I came to the museum, my predecessor, who I shall not name on this occasion, got sent one of these caddis larvae by a collector. It arrived in a tube. He took one look at it and said, "Ah, it's a caddis larva and it's in a dry tube. I better give it some water." So he filled the tube up with water and promptly drowned the first terrestrial caddisfly larva we'd ever had at the museum, which was a bit of a shame. But we did get some more later on. It's actually turned out to be a fairly common species. It lives in damp leaf litter at the, in oak forests, and it is fairly common. It has a wingless female as well. It's a very, very strange beast altogether. And there are one or two marine species of caddisflies. We always hear that there are no or very few true marine insects, but one has been known, in fact, in New Zealand for well over a century now. And there's a rather interesting story about the larvae of it, because the larvae had been found, in fact, been found in Christchurch Harbour, building cases out of seaweed, the very typical caddisfly cases, but built out of fragments of seaweed. But then only about 20 years ago, I should say the female of this species has got a very long ovipositor, almost as long as the rest of the body put together, which is quite unusual. And some 20 years or so ago, some New Zealand workers found caddis larvae inside the body cavity of a starfish. And they reasoned from this that this long ovipositor was in fact for the female to go down under the water, probably in a rock pool or something, probe her ovipositor down through the coelopore of the starfish and inject these caddis larvae in, where they at least hatched initially and then probably came out later, which was the most incredible story. I mean, it explained the length of the ovipositor, but there is now some doubt as whether that really is what happened. And it is being investigated at this very moment about just how these things really do survive. And whether there is a relationship with the starfish, we just don't know. But it would make a nice story if it was true. Just one very odd structure that larvae build. I showed you one of these very brightly coloured caddis, which has got the brown and yellow markings all over it. This is actually a net spinning caddis. It's not really a case building type, but it builds this permanent structure. This is a South American species. It builds a permanent structure in the bottom of the stream it lives in. It looks a bit like a sort of ship's ventilator thing. The current is coming in this direction, goes down this sort of chimney. All the bits get filtered out in the net here, and the excess water goes out the back end. So it's a sort of self-running system driven by the current. The larva sits in this tube down here with its head sticking out where the net is and just grabs little bits as they get stuck on the net, or if it has to repair the net, for example, or clear it of debris or something. So it's a quite remarkable thing, and it really is a permanent structure. It lives its whole life sitting on this one place on the stream bed and then pupates in this section here. So it's really quite a strange thing. It could be commoner than we realise. There's still an awful lot of caddis larvae that have not been discovered. And I just have to tell you one last story about caddis flies, because I'm running out of time, I see. Despite being only about two-thirds of the way through my pages, I shall quickly jump to the end. Evolution's clearly worked very heavily on caddis larvae, but on the larval side, not much on the adults. I mentioned that paper by Herb Ross where he redefined the classification of them, and he put a very nice picture in that paper showing the main differences between a very primitive adult caddisfly and a very advanced adult caddisfly. And that's the picture he put in. Well, I think the primitive one's on the left, but you're going to take my word for that. But clearly there's not much happened to the adult, and they really are. They're just there to mate and die, basically. So all the pressure has been on the larvae. One pressure the larvae have recently had to put up with is people in France and I think in America now as well, using them to make jewellery. I don't know whether you've heard about this, but many of you will know that caddis flies will build from almost anything if it's the right size that they're given to build cases from. I mean, people have given them glass beads to make cases and all the rest, so you can actually see what's happening inside if you give them transparent beads. But there's a very enterprising chap in France who thought, if I give them little bits of gold and gold fragments and so on, I hope this is going to show up. I've got the original picture with me. You can see it afterwards if you like. He actually put them in an aquarium with fragments of gold, and they built cases out of gold. Wonderful. He then took the larva out, dried off the case, and sticks a pin on it, or whatever he does, and sells it for thousands of dollars as natural jewellery. Then, of course, gives the larva a few more fragments, and it builds another one. Just endless. I would call this bio-exploitation, I think. But, or perhaps that just means I wish I'd thought of it myself, or something, I don't know. Anyway, I've got the original picture of that. You can see it later on. I think I ought to quote Isaac Walton at this point from his Complete Angler and say, "I've held you too long about these caddis," which is what he quotes somewhere. Obviously, I'll be happy to answer any questions that I can, because I know I've had to skate over this very quickly. Although it's a very small group of insects, there's clearly a lot you can say about them. So if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thanks very much, Lee. Thank you. Right. Anyone got any questions? Gaydon, yes, sir.
So you mentioned Trichoptera and Baltic antler.
Yes.
Indeed, there are lots, and I gather they're fairly common. My own observations, mm-hmm. They are. Are the Trichoptera that are in the Baltic antler significantly different in any way from a modern day fauna in terms of say, generic or family group composition? And do they tell us anything about the habitat in which the Baltic amber formed?
Right. Gaydon's question about Baltic amber species, whether they reflect modern classification, or whether they tell us anything about the habitat. Well, they are all in modern families. I would say 95% are in modern genera. So they don't tell us much about the fossil history. I mean, the trouble is, even Baltic amber is relatively recent in geological terms, and most of the generic level evolution had already occurred by then, quite clearly. So it doesn't tell us a great deal about what's happening about the habitat either, because so many of these species can migrate quite long distances. They fly a long way from the water that they breed in. So the fact that they're found in that particular type of amber doesn't really tell us anything, because they're flying long distances. So I'm afraid, no, they don't tell us much about the caddis or about the habitat, really. It's just interesting to see them. There are very large numbers. I mean, there are thousands of specimens being described now. And even the species groups look very similar to modern-day ones. So. Yeah. Okay, Kevin, yes?
Given that Trichoptera lark silk has to be manufactured, used, and set entirely underwater, mm-hmm. How similar or different is it to the Lepidoptera lark silk?
Right, Kevin's asking about silk setting underwater. I believe it's chemically very similar, because I would have thought that Lepidopteran silk would set underwater because of the pyralids and so on that are building cases there. But I don't know about that, to be honest. Anyone know about pyralid silk? No? Well, there certainly are fresh...
Under the microscope, it certainly looks very much like ordinary Lepidoptera silk. Yeah. Some of the nuclei.
That's right.
Phil entirely comparable with the med spinning caps, the hydrocycles.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I think that's
chemically the same.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, there certainly are truly aquatic pyralid moths, so I would expect the chemistry to be very similar. I don't know whether spider silk sets underwater. I've never asked anyone, to be honest. Anyone know? No? Okay.
Presumably it does, since you've got ones which build bells underwater.
Well, I suppose that's true, yes.
Black fly silk sets underwater.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, Steve.
You mentioned how the case helps in respiration in standing water. And the net spinning ones living in running water, but there are some net spinning ones in standing water. So how do they feed? And how do they breathe?
Damn, he knows too much, this guy. He's not meant to ask me these questions. Right, Steve's asking how net-spinning caddis catch their prey in still water. There's a surprising amount of small currents, of course, even in so-called still water. And most of them are living at the edges of ponds or lakes. They tend not to be in the middle. I mean, they've got to attach their net to something anyway. So they're usually on twigs or stones or the banks or something. And you tend to get even just convection currents, I think, are enough just to carry very fine particles around, because it's really only single-celled algae and things like that they're feeding on. It's very, very fine organic matter. They're not too fussy about what they eat. So I think it probably works quite well for them. And as the water heats up and cools down through the day, you get enough currents, you know, just minute currents to satisfy that. That's my story anyway. Is that good enough, Steve? Yes, Rory.
So what are the non-net spinning ones living on? What are they eating?
Right, yes, I had to miss out the chunk about feeding. I was going to talk about that. There's all sorts of feeders. There are predators, there are active predators that don't spin nets or build cases. They just rush around like predatory beetle larvae. But some feed on plant material, some graze on algae as scrape it off the surfaces, and some actually feed on filamentous algae. They actually sort of pass them up through the mouth parts like sort of climbing up a rope and suck out the contents of each cell as it goes up through the mouth. It's wonderful to watch these things. So there's all kinds of feeding going on, and all kinds of adaptations to that, which I just didn't have the time. The only filter feeders are the net spinners. Okay. There's no other ones. They've got no structures of their own that they can filter feed with, so they only spin nets that act as external filters, really.
Is the silk which they spin their nets from the same as the silk which they spin to make the base of their cases?
It's all the same silk, whatever they use it for, yes. Whether it's net, whether it's building a larval case or a pupal case or a net or anything, it's the same. Yeah, just a bit conscious of the time. Are we getting a bit? Perhaps we ought to have further questions outside with a glass of alcohol in our hand or something, as it's nearly 10:04. Okay, I'll hand over.
Thank you very much indeed, Peter. Another interesting and informative talk. I think Peter forgot to mention that he has an exhibit here. Which I'm sure you'd all like to come and admire. The case, the beautifully knitted case, which presumably it didn't make itself. And then perhaps you'd all like to go outside and have refreshments as usual. Thank you very much.